I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I wanted to start from the beginning. I want a completely fresh one. Episode 176 of Below the Belt, take two. Joined once again by my good friend John McDonald. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you, Cal. How are you?
I'm good. Hopefully this works all right this time. I was just saying that there's a lot of kind of boxing kind of going on at the minute, but none of it's really there to, it's not really grabbing anybody's attention. It's not really grabbing my attention, to be honest. Sometimes I go on Box Rec and I look at the schedules and it rates them into stars 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Nothing there really. There was the the Josh Warrington and Lee Wood.
Yeah, there's not much on the go at the minute, but we've been spoiled. The first half of the year was really, really good. We had so much on the schedule in the first half of the year, and the second half hasn't just lived up to all those great fights we had from January through June.
Yeah, it's a real shame. I guess there's always going to be kind of peaks and troughs and stuff like that. I guess that's just the nature of the sport, especially with the kind of splintered promoters, and they're not always very good at kind of working with each other. But it is 176, and we're just coming off, you know, kind of a big, you know, heavyweight showdown on TNT. I've got to get away from saying BT Sport. I've been saying BT Sport to people. Have you got out of the BT Sport TNT bit yet, John?
No, I will always be calling it BT Sport. Like, I can't remember how long it took me to start calling Opal Fruit Starburst. You know, it'll probably have a new name by the time I get round to calling it TNT.
Yeah, no, I get you completely. Where I live, there was a shop called, it was called VG's, and it was like a, it's like a small kind of cost cutter type store. It was VG's, and it changed to Mace. And I know there's Mace's in Belfast, because the one and only time I went there, I saw a Mace, and I couldn't believe it. Then it changed to, or what did it change to? Something else. And then it became cost cutter, but I was always one behind. When it was Costco, I was calling it Mace. I was always one behind. The card, what did you think kind of the card over, actually, John?
The card wasn't great. Like, I thought we were going to be on a really late finish. But thankfully, Moses Itauma and Anthony Yard did the business early doors, and we got the main event at a reasonable time. I was worried that they were going to go really late at one stage, but no, the whole thing was wrapped up by about 3 minutes past 11, so it wasn't too bad. What did you make of the card?
Yeah, it wasn't. It was a classic Frank Warren card. Lots of A-sides, lots of people you would recognise on the A-side, but not very much on, you know, standing across the ring from them. And I really don't know what the point was of that Anthony Yard fight, if I'm honest. He hadn't boxed since January. I was at that fight, the fight in January, against Artur Beterbiev. And you think, you know, you know, maybe you'd have come back May, June, and, you know, maybe even earlier than that, you know, and box someone at a decent European level, and then maybe this around this time box someone decent in an eliminator. But no, he gets straight back in. He gets straight back to that thing that Anthony Yard does, which is box a can, box someone that's, you know, too small for him. Number one, that guy was a super middleweight. He was far too small for him. And just not at his level, and he gets him out of there in two rounds. And it's, he just seems to just follow this thing of, okay, he'll box people well below his level and then step well above his own level. It's really weird, isn't it? But it seems to be, it kind of works for him, doesn't it?
It does. And afterwards, Frank Warren's suggestion of matching Anthony Yard with the winner of Buatsi and Aziz makes a lot of sense, because they were trying to make excuses on the broadcast. Like, Steve Bunce was trying to make out that the champions' dance cards are full for the foreseeable future. Well, they're not. No one really wants to fight Arthur Berbiev or Dmitry Bivol. Like, yes, there's a Callum Smith fight going on there, but he could easily get another shot at Berbiev, given Frank's working relationship with Top Rank. There's no one lining up to fight Bivol. Like, he could get those shots, but realistically, they're going to bide their time until they're gone. Buatsi has never shown any great desire to go and jump in with either of those two guys. Dan Aziz would probably take the fight, but it would probably be sensible if he beats Buatsi to get one more. Beating Yard would prove that he is ready for that jump up. I think it makes a lot of sense. Whether Ben Shalom and Frank Warren can sit down and make a deal, probably not, but I actually don't hate the idea of the winner of that fight fighting Anthony Yard. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that makes absolute sense, that Anthony Yard would fight the winner of Dan Aziz and Joshua Buatsi. Like, that makes absolute sense. You know, they're all London based. It'd be easy to make. You could probably do the O2. You might even sell it out. If you get a decent undercard, you could probably sell it out if you put Dubois on there or whoever. If you did a kind of a cross promotion with Boxer, which I know they'll never do, but you know, if you could do something, I think you could probably get a good crowd in. With Wembley Arena, I think they'd definitely sell Wembley Arena out for that. So I'd really like to see that fight. I just have no faith whatsoever that they'll make it.
Oh, no, that's a sad reality. Like, it makes a lot of sense. I think it's the perfect fight all round, which means we probably won't see it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. So let's talk about the main event, Joe Joyce and Zhang up at heavyweight. It was a rematch for the interim WBO heavyweight title, the full title being held by Oleksandr Usyk. I don't know why they needed an interim, because he's just defended it, but there we are. It went pretty much how I felt it would go, to be honest. It was, Joe Joyce looked petrified. He looked like he didn't want to be there. He looked like he didn't know what to do. He looked just not. Do you know what it kind of reminded me of? David Price, Tony Thompson, too.
Yeah.
Like, you've got this guy. Everyone felt it was a fluke stoppage the first time. People were kind of saying that the first time was a fluke for Zhang, that, you know, it was only because of the injury or it was because of the weight, etc. And it just felt like, no, Zhang knew he could get him out of there the second time. And as soon as that straight left hand landed on Joe Joyce in the second round, while Joe Joyce was against the ropes, the writing was on the wall, wasn't it?
Pretty much. Like, it was in a similar pattern to the first, except both of them knew that Zhang was able to hurt Joyce. So as soon as that left hand landed in the second round, Joyce didn't seem to have an answer. His legs stiffened. And at that point, the head movement that he was trying to deploy early on went out the window, because it was very much something he had to think about doing. The second he's buzzed, he's not thinking about it. The low left hand. It's just a bad matchup. Like, it's a really bad style matchup. And I don't get why on earth Frank Warren made the first fight, because he's usually such a risk-adverse promoter. And the selling point here was that Zhang beat Hergovich. Didn't get the decision, but most people who watched that fight thought that Zhang beat Hergovich. So it was get Joyce in, beat him more convincingly. But that's only catering to a hardcore market. the general public didn't watch that. I know it was on a big undercard, but like realistically, the general sports fan still didn't know who Zhang was. It was something that was going to increase Joyce's standing amongst hardcore boxing fans who were already rating him amongst the biggest threats in the division outside the big two. So there really wasn't much to gain. There was a lot to lose. And I think the assumption that Zhang is rubbish is all based from his draw with Jerry Forrest. But Jerry Forrest is a 6'1" southpaw who's quick on his feet, who got knocked down 3 or 4 times in the first 4 rounds, survived, and then really poured it on Zhang when he was tired. Joe Joyce is not 6'1", fleet of foot with quick hands and a southpaw. Like, it was a completely different fighter. In a lot of ways, Joyce...
It was a strange... Do you know what was even stranger? The first fight happened and, you know, he came in quite light, Joyce. And then, you know, Zhang kind of beat him up and closed his eye and they pulled him out because of the eye. But then they made the rematch. That's the funny thing to me is they made the rematch. Like, why? Don't take the rematch. Like, you can blame the weight. You can blame the eye. Move on. Like, move on. Like, just don't do it. Like, because you just knew. It just felt like as soon as they made the rematch, like, he's going to get beaten up again and it's going to be worse. And that's exactly what happened. He got in again with a guy that's, you know, that knew he could hurt him, that had buzzed him in the first fight. And he hadn't boxed a southpaw in forever. He wasn't at 38 years old going to become really good at boxing southpaws. And he got bashed up again. And the knockout, John, disgusting, wasn't it? It was a feint downstairs of a left hand and then a right hook, tight right hook, and just dropped Joyce on his face. It was a sight to see, wasn't it, John?
It was brutal. And, like, I like Joe Joyce. I think he's an interesting character. I think he's a unique proposition in the heavyweight division. I don't want to see him go out like that. And afterwards, Frank Warren saying he should retire, I didn't like that either. Like, that was Frank essentially saying his contractual minimum purse is going to be too high for me to make money on him anymore, so I'd quite like if he'd retire so I don't have to pay him.
I didn't realise he said that. Is that what he said?
He said, I think Joe Joyce should retire, which essentially is the only reason we want him to retire is because you're going to have to pay him. You've got him under contract. You've got a contracted minimum purse that you're going to struggle to make a profit on after back-to-back conclusive defeats like that. You know, he hasn't had a tough career. Like, he's taken a few too many shots, but he hasn't been in brutal war after brutal war. I don't think he's done. I still think he beats the vast majority of guys beneath the top two. What do you think?
Yeah, I think he, you know, he's 38, so yeah, I think you've got to keep him away from southpaws, Zhang, really, and how good he is. And I think he probably gives Usyk and Fury decent fights. I think he gives pretty much any heavyweight a good fight, Zhang. But yeah, with Joyce, I think if you take him away, if you get him away from southpaws and you give him a rebuilding fight, I think you put him back in there with Dubois, and you give Dubois another fight to rebuild, and I think you make that rematch, because I think right now that's the best money fight for both of them, particularly Joyce. Dubois younger, and you could just build Dubois up, just have him fighting Cans, right? You could just have him fighting Cans. He'd have made good money from the Usyk fight, Dubois. He'd have made good money from the Trevor Bryan fight. So he'll be fine. He will be fine. And Joyce would have made pretty good money as well. So I think those two, you could match them up long term. But I think for now, you could just slowly rebuild both of them. But I think that would be, for me, that's the destination, is Dubois and Joyce 2.
It's a very sensible destination. And it's probably,
what do you think of that?
It's probably what we will get, assuming that Joyce's contractual minimal isn't going to be too problematic to have him fight a couple of Cans and for Frank to make a loss on it before chucking him in with Dubois. He might have to chuck him straight in, which could still be a gamble. There's no guarantee that Dubois improved enough and that Joyce deteriorated enough for there to be a different outcome in that fight. I think the other options on the table are if Frank doesn't want to deal with paying Joyce, let Ben Shalom make him an offer for doing Bacoli Joyce on Sky. Like Billy Nelson's been calling for that fight for ages. Yep. If they've got an interest in trying to rebuild Joyce, perhaps something that would make sense is to make an offer to Tony Yoka, who's just lost two on the bounce, is no longer a big draw in France, a repeat of the 2016 Olympic final, and it's essentially a loser retires match.
A loser leaves town.
Yeah.
One of those ones. Yeah, that makes sense, because you've got that. You've got that Olympic final rematch, you know, almost like when Amir Khan first turned.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Over and he had the rematch of his Olympic final. It's a little obviously different to that, but yeah, you could definitely build it off of that, and that might help kind of make up some of the, you know, some of the guaranteed purse that, you know, that Joyce would be on. You know, TNT have put a lot behind Joyce. They've made him a big part of the kind of their marketing campaign, probably because they can't trust Tyson Fury as much. To me, they've obviously like him. They obviously put a lot behind him, and I think, you know, I'm a little worried about Joyce because in the first fight particularly, we've seen him kind of walk through big shots of fighters. And then the first fight, in the first Zhang fight, you saw him get, it wasn't just the eye, you saw him get hurt, you saw him get buzzed and saw him get hurt. And this time you saw the same thing, and now you've seen him get put on his face. And what worries me kind of about Joyce, it's maybe a little harsh, is that if the chin's gone, if he's got to 38 and all the sparring and all the fights have caught up with him and the chin's gone, what's left? You know, he's still a good fighter, but he's very, very slow. He's 38 years old, and the chin might have gone. So I'm a little worried about him for that. So I can, you know, if you've used a stick up for Frank, you could perhaps say, well, maybe he's, you know, seeing the same thing. You know, his chin's gone, and he's really slow, and he's just going to get himself hurt. But I think you're right. I don't think Frank Warren thinks like that. He promoted a Derek Chisora fight not long ago. So, It's a concern, isn't it? It's a concern with Joyce. But I kind of want to talk about Zhang, though. I thought he was excellent.
He was excellent. And Zhang is one of these guys that for the first half of a fight, he's one of the most dangerous heavyweights in the division at the minute. As we've seen against Jerry Forrest when he really tired in the second half, and against Hergovich where in the last three rounds he didn't do an awful lot, he does tire. If a fighter can get through the first 4 to 6 rounds without taking too much damage, Zhang is there to be taken out in the second half of a fight. But he is so dangerous in those first early rounds that there's no guarantee that you are going to be in a position to capitalise and take him out in the second half of a fight. He dictates pace behind that big, slow southpaw jab on the left hand, that it's difficult to try and get him to work hard for those first 6 rounds. So, like, he's a handful. I think he beats the vast majority of people beneath Usyk and Fury. But I also think the same about Joyce. I don't think Joyce has done either. I think that both those guys beat most people beneath them in the rankings.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Yeah, I wonder what could, you know, Zhang after the fight called out Tyson Fury. You know, he said, you know, we was close to making that fight, but then, you know, Joyce exercises rematch clause, and I don't. Do you see a world where Fury takes that fight?
No, I don't. I don't think he needs to take that fight. I don't think that there's enough money on the table for that fight. If the money's there, I'm sure he will take it. But I think that he's just got bigger money options available to him, and he's been very open as of late about saying that these last few years about his career are about getting as much money as possible. So there would have to be huge, huge money on the table for him to take on a monstrous punching southpaw.
Yeah, it seems to be, you know, box for Fury, it seems to be about, you know, kind of box, you can't box in America, so you know boxing in Saudi and try, or maybe doing stadium fights over here and then trying to make as much money as he can, hence the Netflix documentaries. And I wouldn't call it a documentary, it's more a reality show, isn't it? Netflix reality show and everything else. And yeah, I think you're right. I don't think there's a world he boxes Zhang. I'm not even sure he'd box Usyk. He said as much on his reality show that there's kind of no reason for him to box Usyk, because it's a no win for him. If he wins, he's beat a middleweight. If he loses, he's lost to a middleweight, you know. Who do you think Zhang does get next? Do you think he gets any of the big names, or gets anyone that we know of, or do you think people might start to avoid him a little bit now?
Well, he's the WBO mandatory, so he'll get Usyk at some point. There isn't a huge queue of people willing to fight Usyk. If there isn't a unification with Fury or a Wilder fight on the table, probably the next best earner for him, and also clears his mandatory, is to fight Zhang. And I think he wins that one comfortably. I think he is a horrible style matchup for Zhang. He's too quick of foot. His hands are too fast. He's durable. He's clever. He'll make Zhang work hard, and he'd stop him in the second half. And it would be making a statement on the back of Zhang arguably beating Hrgović and stopping Joyce twice. That's how I see it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think... I like Zhang. I liked watching him, but I think he had a target in front of him that was, Joyce almost went in there knowing he was going to lose. I think he probably knew within the first 30 seconds he was going to lose the fight. He saw this big towering bloke in front of him from a southpaw stance, and probably from that left hand in the second round, he knew he was going to lose. But, you know, that sort of performance can kind of make you believe that Zhang is as good as he is, perhaps better than what perhaps he actually really is. Yeah, I agree with you. I think Usyk would beat him. Usyk's, you know, kind of the number one right now, just because Fury's playing a day. I was talking to someone in the pub yesterday. I went to the pub and someone was asking me about Fury. And I said, Fury's playing a very dangerous game, actually, because he's at an age, what is he, 34 now? He's boxing Francis Ngannou, but before that he's boxed Chisora. Before that he's boxed Dillon, who looked horrible. He's not boxed a live body in quite a while, and he's playing a dangerous game. At some point he's going to have to get in there with a live body, and he might find himself come unstuck because of it. So yeah, I think there's something going. I don't know. I think Fury's playing he's on a slippery slope, really. I think, but that's probably why he's fighting the people he's fighting. Maybe he can feel himself slowing down. He definitely is. But yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. To be fair, what's else? Anything on the undercard stand out for you, John?
Not particularly. Like as we said, Yard had a Yard fight. Moses Itauma went through the gears nicely, got an early stoppage. Pierce O'Leary looks an interesting prospect. That was about it for me. What did you think?
Yeah, there wasn't really... That was a decent fight, the O'Leary fight. That was interesting. That was quite interesting. He won in the end, but yeah, I quite enjoyed that. That was quite interesting. But overall, like I said before, it was a typical kind of Frank undercard show where, you know, lots of A-sides, not so many B-sides. But still, I think not... bad, a decent kind of a decent show. In the early hours, I was told.
Hey, Cal.
Yes, hello.
Sorry, I lost what you said there.
I just said I was told that you stayed up to the early hours to watch Conor Ben's return.
No, I'm not that much of a sadist. I watched it the next morning, thankfully, through the convenience of an app. One of the few good things about the own app is you can watch things at your own convenience, spoiler-free. That is one of the better things. Yes, unfortunately, I did watch Conor Benn. Is Conor Benn the Michael Barrymore of British boxing? Because technically, Michael Barrymore is... technically Michael Barrymore is clear to work. He has claimed to be innocent at every available opportunity for a very long time, but we all believe that the only reason he is currently clear to work is because of a very good legal team. Are you seeing the similarities?
I can. Michael Barrymore is a fantastic comparison. Everybody, we know what you are, but but you've managed to, you've paid a few quid, got a good legal team and managed to, you know, be found not guilty. And it's really interesting, actually, with Connor, Ben, because they keep using the word cleared. It's very intentional. It's very intentional. They keep using that word, even when they say cleared to box. Not he's free to box or he's allowed to box, cleared to box. They keep using the word cleared because they're trying to put this word into and it's really quite strange PR exercise. And then the whole announcement video of him boxing at the weekend, that he was going to box at the weekend, it was like, I've been knocking people out with 18-ounce gloves on. It's like, mate, you've just come off a performance-enhancing drug case, and all you're talking about is how fucking hard you hit. Like, so weird. Like, it's so weird to say, like, oh, I'm just happy to be back in the ring, la, la, la. But no, he talked about how hard he punches. It was so strange. And then he gets, you know, he steps up to 154, gets in the ring and doesn't get the stoppage after all that talk. But how did he look?
Not great. Like, Orozco was there to be hit. He was slow, but he was able to take everything Ben threw at him. Ben won comfortably, but if you're looking to come back with a bang, you're looking to get rid of that guy in a couple of rounds, have a stoppage that's going to go viral. Instead, all they've got is Chris Eubank Jr. commenting on how bad he looked and Conor Benn responding to it and Eddie in Matchroom retweeting that. That's what they've got now to try and promote Conor Benn, is that Chris Eubank Jr. thought he looked a bit shit.
And that's it now. And he said, I didn't watch the fight. I had to get up and go out first thing Sunday morning, so I didn't get to watch it. But I did see some comments. He said, oh, you know, Britain's my home and I'd like to be able to box back there again. Okay, well, fucking sit down with the board then, mate, and apply for a license and you know, maybe show some humility. And maybe, you know, maybe you might be able to box in Great Britain again, maybe. You know, it's just such a strange thing that's gone on with him. It's going to be interesting. You know, him at 154, I always felt like he was kind of a small welter, John. And now he's, you know, I guess because when he went up to middleweight to box Eubank, do you think that's where he'll stay? He'll stay at 154?
It seems that way. Like, he looked pretty filled out on the scales, assuming that his knockout power returns and that this was just a blip. I can see 154, because particularly if he goes up to 160 or close to it for Eubank, coming back down to 147 is going to be problematic. So he doesn't have a big frame for 154, but you know, the eggs seem to have filled him out nicely.
The eggs, yeah, lots of protein in the eggs. Yeah, it's we'll see. I don't know what, you know. Well, obviously, we're about to come on to it. Canelo and Jermell Charlo. So, you know, there's a very good chance that the belts are going to become splintered at 154. So he might be able to get into the mix for that. He may have to do some kind of political gymnastics with trying to get back up the rankings at 154. And then you're going to have Terence Crawford, who might step up at some point as well. So it's a tough division. It's a tough division. I'm not sure what he does up there. I think he might even have a tougher time up there than he would have done at 147. It's not an easy division at all. And PBC have kind of had it in a stranglehold for quite a while now, 154. But we'll see. I'm not sure what he'll do there. Not sure I particularly care. I'll be keeping an eye on him just so I can see him lose, to be honest. I'm just waiting for the defeat. And if he fights Eubank at 160, all I want is for Eubank to not accept anything under 160 pounds and no rehydration clause. If he does that, then I think Eubank beats him handily. That's it. I think that's the only attention I'll pay to Conor Benn, to be honest. And then the main event on the night, like with Sandy Ryan, you know, boxed to a draw against Jessica McCaskill. You felt that was a clear as day robbery, right?
Yeah, like, I don't like the term robbery. Broadly speaking, it gets thrown about way too often. A lot of the times there's swing rounds where you can make a case, and even if it's sometimes that you need to give one fighter the benefit of the doubt in every round, I still don't classify it as robbery if it is a swing round, whereas this was bad. Like, Mark Streisand handed out a card of 97-93 in favour of Jessica McCaskill. Like, I don't think Barbara Streisand could have scored that fight any worse. Honestly, it was terrible. Wow. Like, I had that fight 97-93 to Sandy Ryan. A lot of people had it slightly wider at 98-92. Even the draw is a bad card. Like, I just... Yeah. I don't know how they reached that conclusion. Like, finally we've got a British fighter being on the wrong end of the decision that away fighters get in Britain pretty regularly at the minute.
Do you know what? I saw that fight. I saw that fight announced, and I thought initially that it was over here in the UK. And then I thought, oh, Sandy Ryan will win that. Jessica McCaskill, you know, she looked awful against Chantal Cameron. Chantal Cameron made her look like shit, to be honest. But we've seen since the Katie, you know, as well as the Katie Taylor, with the Katie Taylor fight, that she's an exceptional fighter and one of the best women's fighters in the world, Chantal Cameron. But I thought McCaskill looked awful in that fight. And she's pushing 40. She's not far away from being 40. And I just thought Sandy Ryan will win that. And then I saw it was in America. I was like, ah. And it's not because I think, oh, American judges, that means it's bad. But location just plays such a big part. When you're traveling and you're going over to the States, it's just that bit harder to win the fights, whether it's because you're uncomfortable outside of your comfort zone, or the jet lag, or you don't have your home fans. It's not all the, you know, kind of the officials you know and all of that. And I just thought, So when I saw a draw come in, I thought, yeah, not surprised at that at all. Do you think they do a rematch?
Yeah, like, I'd be surprised if there isn't a rematch. I don't know where else there's going to be that sort of money on the table for McCaskill. I've seen that Clifton Mitchell's already said that he wants it back in the UK in Derby. So we'll see. Like, it should happen. It was a really bad decision. On the upside, Sandy Ryan didn't lose her world title belt as a result, but she should be a unified welterweight champion right now. Not. And it is a bit rubbish, but as you said, like, it is difficult going abroad. It's why the wins that Josh Taylor has over Jose Ramirez and Kell Brook has over Sean Porter in the States are deemed to be so impressive, because it is just that little bit harder when you're away from home comforts. And if there are close rounds, the judges will usually score in favour of the home fighter. Like, Japan is one of the rare countries where an away fighter can get a fair shake on the cards. Everywhere else it's bad. We're one of the worst. Like, we've jobbed umpteen fighters over here in the last 5 years. So it's not right. It's something that boxing really does need to address, but sadly it's not uncommon.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's not something that's, you know, it's not hard, really. Like, if somebody wins clear, they win clear. You know, these people work really, really hard. Just score one round at a time, you know, and it's just happening, you know, kind of far too often now, really. And it doesn't matter where it is. I think you're right. We are the worst for it in the UK. And the board have kind of, you know, they took a bit of a hammering on Channel 4 the other night. But, you know, they've been not up to it for a long time, and they've played the babyface role in this place in this thing with Conor Benn. But the board need to fucking sort it out, and so do some of the commissions in America as well. It's a Florida. Yeah, I saw Florida, and I thought, oh well, they've licensed Conor Benn for one, and now, you know, they've thrown out cars like that as well. It was really, really disappointing. Was there anything else on the undercard that leapt out at you on that night?
Well, technically, the main event was Richardson Hitchens against Zepeda. And Hitchens won comfortably, but he just it's a bit boring. His style isn't going to sell tickets. He's not going to have people queuing up to fight him because he's hard to beat. He's very risk adverse. He knows who he is as a fighter. It's going to make him hard to beat, but it's going to make him hard to watch. Like, it's Demetrius Andrade all over again, unfortunately. Like, he's going to need to do something to make himself more watchable.
Yeah, it's a real shame. He's got to... We were talking about this offline, wasn't we? You know, there's been boring fighters in the past, or perhaps fighters that are a little bit more defensive, or, you know, try not to ship so much. But you've got to do something to grab people's attention. You know, you've got to do something. You know, remember, you know, Billy Joe Saunders against David Lemieux doing the little look into the crowd. He's not the most exciting fighter, but he did something just to make you go, oh, that was interesting. Or, you know, Bernard Hopkins would do something. He'd do the press-ups in between rounds against Jean Pascal. You know, do something to make people want to watch you, you know. And he's going to have to do something. He's going to have to learn to either, you know, kind of promote his personality outside of the ring, which a lot of the influencer YouTuber types do, or you've got to do something in the ring that gets people's attention, even if you don't want to ship too many shots. But be interesting to see where he kind of goes from there. And then this weekend, John, it's the return of Canelo Alvarez against, you know, Jermell Charlo. He's gone back to PBC. He's kind of jumped around all over the place, hasn't he, Canelo? Good for him. I think it's good that he does that. He goes to promoter and, you know, goes where the fights are. And I think actually he's done the smart thing, hasn't he? Fighting Bivol in a rematch was not going to end well for him. And losing back to back against, you know, against one guy is just not, it's not what you want to see from a guy like Canelo. So how are you feeling about this weekend, about him fighting Jermell Charlo? Do you give Jermell a chance?
I give him a slim chance, and that's because I think Charlo has probably been at 154 a bit too long. I think it's why there's been some flat performances, like against Castanho in the first fight, etc., etc. I think 160 would have been better for him, but also there's signs of decline in Canelo in the Ryder fight, in the B-ball fight. So it's intriguing. I still lean fairly heavily towards Canelo, but I'm interested. It's not one that... Some Canelo fights, I'm like, it's a foregone conclusion. Like, I'll catch that in the morning. But I might get up for one. Like, it's certainly interesting. How do you see it?
Yeah, I'm interested in it, and I do give Jermell a shot. I think they'd have to get the game plan right. Because, you know, he's going to get the, you know, how it is with Canelo fights. They fill out the scorecards, the first five rounds at least, before it's even started. So he's going to have to box out of his skin in order to get the win. And we've seen with the Castanho fight and the Tony Harrison fights that he needed the rematch to kind of work the style out and get the win. He doesn't have that this time. Like, he doesn't get a do over. Like, this is his opportunity, and he has to grab it with both hands. I give him a chance because he was big at 154, and actually, in terms of both of them, in terms of their frame, they're similar size guys, and, you know, Jermell's, you know, a good bit taller. So I give him a shot, definitely. But you would think that you would make Canelo favorite, and then I suppose they move him on to David Benavidez after that, if they want, or if Canelo wants it. He's never really seemed interested in boxing him. But you'd think it would be David Benavidez next. You think a stoppage, points? What are you looking at?
I would probably lean towards a sort of 116, 112, 117, 111 sort of scorecard, which will probably result in 120, 108. But that's how I see it. I don't think Canelo will get the stoppage. As I say, there's just some signs of decline when he fought John Ryder and Golovkin. Like, I think the Canelo of 3 years ago would probably have got rid of John Ryder. So that's how I see it. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I there's definitely slippage with Canelo. You know, I think you're right. You know, he gets rid of John Ryder in three rounds. You know, back in the pandemic when he was really at his prime and had cemented himself as the best fighter in the world, I think that version of him stops John Ryder within three, four rounds, to be honest. And for John Ryder to for him to you know, to take John Ryder that long, and the Golovkin fight, really, you know, Golovkin has been really inactive. He's been semi-retired, and he's been at middleweight forever. 41 years old. I thought, come on, he's got to be looking to get Golovkin out of there, really. And he won, handily enough, but it wasn't particularly impressive, the Golovkin fight. So, yeah, and Jermell, you know, new weight division. You know, he's got size on his side. You know, he's on form. He's not undefeated, but you know, he's undisputed champion himself until the ring walk, and then the WBO are going to strip him of the belt straight away afterwards, which is ridiculous. So he's a live body in there, Jermell. But I think I slightly disagree with you on the cards. I'm going to predict a majority decision. I think one card's going to give him a draw. I think he might get a draw card. I think he might get a draw card and then two for Canelo.
Stranger things have happened.
And then this weekend go on.
Stranger things have happened, and Canelo, back in his 154 days, had those really tight decisions against good boxers like Lara and Trout and people. So it's not impossible.
And Jermell will have his fans there. He'll have his fans there, and I'm sure they'll make a lot of noise as well. And he's the PBC guy, isn't he? He is the PBC, you know, kind of lifer, if you like. So, you know, if there's someone they want to look after, surely it's Jermell. But you never know. You never know. It'd be interesting, and then it'll be interesting to see what Tim Zhu does at 154 once, you know, Jermell gives up all the belts, which you think he probably will after the fight. And then this weekend it's Jai Oppertaia against Jordan Thompson. This is so strange, John. I don't understand them signing him. I don't understand it, because they've got no one to match him with. And they're putting him on a card in London. They're not doing Australia or New Zealand where he's from. They're putting him on in Wembley, at Wembley Arena, against Jordan Thompson. And then the undercard looks really rubbish. Are you looking forward to just seeing this? Just because we get to see Oppertaia?
I like Oppertaia. I think he's the best cruiserweight in the world. As for why Matchroom signed him, I think it's a little bit vindictive. I think they signed him to try and make Boxer and Ben Shalom's life a little bit harder. They were looking at making a Reactor fight. They've got a call with the Billum Smith. I think Eddie was just making sure that they weren't going to get one piece of the cruiserweight puzzle, and he's going to try and find whatever opportunities he can for him. I don't think Jordan Thompson's ready. I think Jordan Thompson has got one of the worst nicknames in all of professional boxing, the practitioner of artistic violence. What in the name of fuck is that?
I've never heard that. The practitioner of what?
Artistic violence.
It's original.
Original doesn't mean good.
Yeah, he's not the hitman, the body snatcher, the crusher. He is whatever you said. I've forgotten it again already. fair play to him. It's not particularly catchy. It's not catchy. It's not good, but it's original. So we'll give him that. You think Oppertaia is going to get him out of there?
Yeah, I think so. Jordan Thompson shown vulnerability. Dutsar almost got him out of there in the final round of their fight. I think Oppertaia, as a well-schooled southpaw boxer puncher, will get this job done. Probably a couple of cagey rounds to figure out Thompson, because he does have huge dimensions for the weight. He's tall, he's reachy, etc., etc. But I think once Oppertaia works him out, it's going to be one-way traffic. How do you see it?
Yeah, I agree. I thought about going, still might, don't know, not paying, but, you know, still might. But, yeah, I'm interested in seeing Oppertaia. I've seen some bits and pieces of him, but to see him properly will be really good. I think he'll get the stoppage. I imagine he'll get the stoppage. The undercard is doing nothing for me, absolutely nothing for me at all. But I guess they've got to pay Oppertaia, and, you know, they've got to claw the money back somehow. So, yeah, that should it should be interesting to see Opetai up close at least. You never know, Jordan Thompson might have the fight of his life, you know. And actually, I was thinking about, you know, with, you know, with them signing Opetai and then, like you said, with Boxer, and they've got Riakpor and Akoli and Billum Smith. You know, and you think about it, in America, where kind of Top Rank kind of had the lightweights on lock, and then you've got PBC, you had the welters and the light middle, and then, you know, Sauerland's had cruiserweight for a while. I think there's something in that, John, of just promoters. You know, I think it would be nice. We're never going to get a UFC type monopoly, but maybe what we could have is if the a silent agreement between promoters to just leave some divisions, you know, to almost like divvy up the divisions between each other. And, you know, you can have cruiser, but I'm having super middle. Do you know what I mean? It just seems, you know, Opetai would have been so much better, him going to boxer. It would have made so much more sense going there. You could have had unifications. There'd have been really tasty fights. And now you've got Opetai who's going to fight Jordan Thompson. And then what? It's just feels like a shame, really, John.
Absolutely. And when divisions have been on lockdown by certain promoters, it's occasionally worked out well for us. Like 154 with PBC has produced a series of fantastic fights, upsets. It's been great. With Top Rank and lightweight, not so much. It's resulted in one champion, which is great. Do like that. Couple of interesting fights, but broadly speaking, not really set the world alight. So, yeah, like, I think if there's enough depth there, it's a really good thing for one promoter to have it on lockdown, but most of the time they don't really have the depth. It's why, like, Top Rank keep on wheeling out Richard Comey, for example.
Yeah, it's a fair point. They get, and you'd actually notice on the undercard for the weekend, PBC are wheeling out a lot of kind of the old guys that have been around forever and perhaps don't deserve the opportunity, but they're getting it because they're with PBC. Could be in that spot, really. You know, Ugas is boxing again, Terrell Gausch is boxing again, like he's been around forever. So yeah, I get your point. I think you're right. I think there's something in that, having a monopoly in a division. I think there's some positives around that, but there's definitely some negatives as well, like there always is with any monopoly, really. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me on, as always, much appreciated.
All right, take care.
Take care.
Sports Social Podcast Network.